This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Technik, die bewegt. Design, das begeistert. Erlebe Elektromobilität in neuem Licht. Mit dem neuen innovativen Kia EV4 und dem neuen geräumigen SUV Kia EV5. Entdecke beide vollelektrischen Modelle ab 17. Januar bei uns.
Kia. Movement that inspires.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vietor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, we dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.
Welcome to Lady Killers from Radio 4 with me, Lucy Worsley, where true crime meets history with a twist. In this episode, we're investigating the Ilford murder, a suburban stabbing that turned into one of the most sensational trials of all time. This is the story of how an ordinary woman who witnessed the violent killing of her husband found herself on trial for his murder.
I heard him call out and he fell up against me. I put out my arms to save him and found blood, which I thought was coming from his mouth.
A woman came running towards us from the opposite direction. She was hysterical and said, "For God's sake, help, my husband has fallen down bleeding from his head."
She called, "Oh my God, will you help me? My husband is ill, he is bleeding."
I struck a match and saw that he was saturated in blood.
The doctor came and told me my husband was dead. My husband and I were talking about going to a dance.
I'm joined by an all-female team of detectives to investigate the ordinary lives and extraordinary crimes of some of the most intriguing murderesses of the 19th and 20th centuries. Edith Thompson. Our alleged murderess loves to dance. In fact, as a child, she excels at dancing and acting. As an adult, she longs for anything that might lift her out of the humdrum of her everyday suburban life. So, on the 3rd of October 1922, Edith Thompson and her husband Percy are making their way home after an evening out at the Criterion Theatre. On this particular night, she and Percy catch the 11:30 train home to Ilford. The bright lights of the West End are far behind them when their night takes a horrible turn. Professor Rosalind Crone from the Open University, our in-house Lady Killers historian, went to the very road in Ilford where our murder took place.
I'm walking up Belgrave Road in Ilford, East London. Now, I've brought a police map with me and... yeah, according to the map, I've reached the scene of the crime. We have blood stains start here and they extend for about 44 feet to blood stains end here, right next to this gateway.
As Edith and Percy are going along Belgrave Road, a man jumps out from behind bushes and attacks Percy. There's a violent struggle. Percy is stabbed. The attacker flees.
I have with me Edith's statement. Actually, Edith's second statement to the police. A man rushed out from the gardens and knocked me away from my husband. I was dazed for a moment.
I tried to hold him up. He staggered for several yards towards Kensington Gardens and then he fell against the wall and slid down.
I'm joined by our guest detective, Sasha Woss, KC. She's taken on some of the legal system's most notable cases involving Rosemary West, Rolf Harris and Johnny Depp. Now, at this stage on the night of the murder, Edith is a witness, isn't she? She's not a suspect.
That's correct. There's no hint at that stage that she knows the assailant.
But she is taken in for questioning, and then she's a bit vague. Is that fair to say about exactly what happened?
If you wanted to be very critical of Edith, her story involves a number of contradictions about whether Percy collapsed, whether he was injured, whether he was attacked.
So there's something a little bit off here. Perhaps not all is as it seems. Is Edith an innocent witness, or Could she be a devious, cold-blooded murderess? Who is Edith Thompson? Our resident historian, Rosalind Crone, is back in Ilford, outside Edith's house.
Well, here we are on Kensington Gardens, and this is a really nice street. These are big houses. These are double-fronted terraces, front door in the middle, bay windows on either side. This is 1920s suburban paradise. Being able to commute really easily from Ilford train station into work, this is where you wanted to be if you were middle class and ambitious.
Edith Jessie Thompson is born in 1893, towards the end of the Victorian period. Edith leaves school in 1909, and by 1911 she's found a job at Carlton and Pryor, a wholesale milliner's, producers of some very fashionable hats. They're located in the heart of the City of London. She's promoted very quickly from clerk to buyer. She teaches herself French and she goes on business trips to Paris. She even uses her maiden name, Graydon, when she's at work. And she earns more than her husband, Percy.
Moving in here. Now, this was a really big step for the couple. I think a kind of mark of their affluence that they had done really well. And arguably, that was largely driven by Edith. While this house was in Percy's name, it was Edith who had paid the lion's share for it.
Now, what about Percy? He's also a clerk at a shipping company, but he doesn't seem to progress that far with his career. He eventually enlists in wartime, and quite swiftly, he's medically discharged. Truth be told, he's a bit of a hypochondriac.
Edith was definitely taking advantage of some of the opportunities that started to appear in the post-war era. A series of kind of gradual changes in the lives of women that began to deliver tangible results. So, for example, contraception became more available for married couples, and there were career opportunities for those in a position to take advantage. Edith was what contemporaries would have called a new woman, but she grew up in the Victorian and Edwardian times, and she was still under the weight of those expectations, values around sex and marriage and children that lasted all the way up until the 1960s. And Edith was a girl who liked to party.
It was rather fun on Thursday at the garden party. They had swings and roundabouts and slip-slaps, coconut shies, Aunt Sally's, hoopla and all that sort of thing. I went in for them all and shocked a lot of people, I think.
There we hear Edith enjoying life in this new era of the Roaring Twenties. For this generation of young women, the air is fizzing with opportunity. It's the age of the flapper. Headlines are rising. Many women, not just Edith, are starting to earn their own money, to spend as they please. I think that calls for a cocktail. Edith Thompson, with her bobbed hair and her jaunty dresses, frequenting theatres, dancing the nights away.
Have you ever seen Le Rouge et Noir? They are all ex-soldiers running a concert party, impersonating girls as well as men. Very clever and very funny. I did laugh such a lot.
And then, cherry on the cake, she gets a lover, Freddie Bywaters.
You are going to love me always, aren't you? Even when you're cross with me. And when you are, I'll ruffle all your hair lots of times until you have to melt and smile at me. Then you'll take me in both your arms and hold me so tight I can't breathe, and kiss me all over until I have to say, stop, stop at once.
Freddie Bywaters went to school with Edith's younger brother, Bill. He's only 18, 8 years younger than Edith. He's a sailor and a ship's steward, and he has tales of travel and adventure. And he's devastatingly handsome. He's friendly with Edith's whole family. In fact, he's previously courted her younger sister, Avis. But in June 1921, while on holiday on the Isle of Wight, Edith Thompson and Freddie Bywaters begin an affair.
If only I had you here to put my head on your shoulder and just sleep and dream and forget. Darling, come to me soon. I want you badly, more and more.
Yes, she did say darling. That was one of their pet names. Petey was another one. It's a passionate relationship, but it's also a meeting of minds. In Freddie, Edith's found someone who shares her love of theatre, literature and fantasy. The affair happens right under the nose of staid old Percy. Freddie even lodges for a while in the Thompsons' house. But then, when Percy and Edith once have an argument, Freddie tries to intervene. Percy suspects that his wife has had her head turned and throws him out. From that point, with Freddie back sailing round the globe, Edith and Freddie continue their relationship through letters.
I do hate this life I lead. I hate the lies, hate everything. If only I could make an absolutely clean, fresh start, it would all be so different. I'd be so different too. And we're going to start a fresh, new, clean life together soon, darling, aren't we? Tell me we are. Tell me you are confident, positive we are. I want telling all the time to make me hope on.
Between November 1921 to the end of September 1922, Edith writes letters to Freddie, over 60 of them, and they are steamy. They are passionate.
Darlingest boy, you said to me, say no, Petey, say no. But at that very moment, you didn't wish me to say no, did you? You felt you wanted all me in exchange for all you. I knew this, felt this.
When Freddie's back from his voyages, they meet in person too.
I'm about a 15-minute walk now from Edith and Percy's house, and I'm in Wanstead Park. There's this big clearing with a lake, and there are also these spots of woodland. It really feels very private and very intimate. Now, we know that they met here because it was referenced in some of the letters that they exchanged, and I brought one of these letters with me, actually one from Freddie to Edith, which is quite unusual because Edith tended to destroy Freddie's letters. Darling, in the park, our park on Saturday, you were my little devil. I was happy then, PD, were you? I wasn't thinking of other things, only you, darling. It's really important not to kind of underestimate the riskiness of what they were doing, not just sex outside or intimacy outside, but the whole nature of their affair. Popular images from the 1920s, the short skirts, the nightclubs, they all suggest a loosening of morals and sexual freedom. However, for most ordinary people, marriage continued to be their destination, and respectability was really important. This does not mean, though, that there was no awareness of marital discord or extramarital affairs. The dramatic rise in divorce rates between 1910 and 1920, from about 700 a year to 4,000, suggests that perhaps there was more awareness than ever before. And divorce law reform. It was on the horizon. In 1923, women would be able to divorce their husbands on equal terms, that is, for committing adultery. However, in 1922, Edith could not have easily got divorced. She would have needed to prove that Percy had had an affair and also that he was cruel in some way to her.
So, Sasha, we've got a woman with a secret lover, who seems to be stuck in an unhappy marriage. Does this make her likely to be considered more readily as a suspect?
I think it provides a motive for the prosecution, because the prosecution became interested in Edith as a defendant after they learned that she was having an affair. Like all statements, if they come out on a drip-drip basis, you come across as somebody who's not being entirely frank. The best thing to do is put your cards all on the table straight away.
An error by Edith. So, following the murder, the police get a tip-off from Percy's brother. Richard Halliday Thompson tells them that Edith has taken this younger lover. The next day, Bywaters is arrested at his home in Upper Norwood, and in the drain, just a few yards away from where Percy had died, a bloody dagger is found. Freddie Bywaters cooperates willingly with the police. He confesses that he was the person who leapt from the bushes and dealt the blow that killed Percy. He says that he merely wanted to confront Percy to try to get him to grant Edith a divorce, and this was a scuffle that got out of hand. He consistently maintains that he acted without Edith's knowledge. But then, during their investigations, the police discover the 62 letters from Edith to Freddie that he'd been keeping in his Siemens box, and another 5 at home in his room.
Darlingest, will you please take these letters back now?
I feel scared to death in case anybody else should read them.
Sasha, what is the vital importance of these letters?
The letters contain a number of references by Edith to killing or poisoning her husband. Now, that's not how he died, but they indicated a malicious animus towards him.
What sort of thing?
She was talking about grinding up light bulbs and putting them in his mashed potato.
I was buoyed up with the hope of the light bulb, and I used a lot. Big pieces too. Not powdered.
She was talking about adding belladonna, which is a toxic substance, to his food. But none of this corresponded, A, to the way that Percy did meet his death, or B, with anything that had realistically happened, because there was an exhumation of Percy in due course to check whether indeed there were traces of belladonna or broken glass, and there were neither.
So this fantasy about killing him seemed to be part of their sort of love world, their fantasy life.
It was certainly part of Edith's fantasy life.
So what does she actually get charged with in 1922?
They were both charged with murder, and for the avoidance of doubt, they could both be charged with murder today on similar facts, on the basis, if the Crown's case was sustainable, and she was saying to him, get rid of my husband, I can't stand it, we'll be walking down Belgrave Road at 11 o'clock, and Freddie comes along and stabs him. They would both be part of a joint enterprise to kill him. Mm. And they could both be charged with murder. Whether the evidence was sufficient in Edith's case is an entirely different matter.
If you were back then in 1922, Sasha, would you have prosecuted Edith at all?
I think the evidence against Edith was slim. I think it was just sustainable to bring that prosecution, but I personally would have advised against it had I been asked in 1922.
There's the potential for all kinds of romantic high drama here.
Absolutely.
You can see why this is a case people are still talking about. Gosh. The trial begins on the 6th of December 1922 at the Old Bailey. Newspapers report that people queue from the early hours to get a front row seat in the courtroom.
The diffused electric lights around the oak-panelled room and the presence of hatless but well-dressed women chatting, munching chocolates, were reminiscent of a theatre scene between acts.
Edith, of course, is a keen theatre-goer, and now she is centre stage.
At the end of the paragraph, you say, "Now, I think whatever else I try it in again will still taste bitter. He will recognise it and be more suspicious still, and if the quantity is still not successful, it will injure any chance I may have of trying when you come home." Does that mean trying to poison your husband?
That is what I wanted him to infer.
You were wanting him to entertain the hope that when he next came home, you would try again to poison your husband.
I wanted to convey that impression to his mind by the letter, although I never intended to do such a thing.
Is it the fact, then, that whether that incident is an actual incident or not, what you were speaking of in that paragraph as something you were going to try had been discussed between you and him when you were together?
Yes.
That's pretty damaging. What do you think?
Well, again, it goes back to what she was writing about and whether it could be taken as realistic, whether it was fantasy, and most importantly, whether it actually played any part in what happened in Belgrave Road on the 3rd of October, which was very different from anything that Edith had written about or asked Freddie to do for her.
What do you make of the idea that when she talks about putting bitter leaves into a tea, she's not trying to poison him as much as bring on a miscarriage for herself because she's got pregnant?
That was a possibility. I mean, the difficulty is that Edith was not very forthcoming about what she actually meant and what was actually fantasy. So she came across very badly as a witness and came across as a liar, not because she was necessarily lying, but because she couldn't be frank in circumstances where really you had to be frank. Being in court is not a time to be coy or shy in any way. You have to tell the truth, because if you don't, you're found out.
Oh, I get that. And yet the courtroom was packed. Imagine the shame of explaining all your kind of sexual colloquialisms to all those people.
Will you look at page 86, exhibit 27? The page I want you to look at there is page 88. You say there, I had the wrong porridge today, but I don't suppose it will matter. I don't seem to care much either way. You'll probably say I am careless, and I admit I am, but I don't care. And what were you referring to there when you said, I had the wrong porridge today?
I was referring to... I really cannot explain.
What do you think I had the wrong porridge today could be meaning? I mean, she doesn't want to talk about it.
I understood that to be a euphemism, I have to say, when she talks about porridge and the wrong porridge.
Perhaps it refers to some kind of sexual practice that she doesn't want to share. When I had the wrong porridge today, she meant she had her husband's porridge rather than Freddie's porridge.
Absolutely.
Let's go no further with this.
It's like telephone sex. It doesn't translate well into the court setting. It remains like that today because, of course, today many trials revolve around texts between people who have been in relationships. And again, they're to be read in private. And they're not usually received very sympathetically by people in the cold light of a courtroom.
Interesting. So is it the letters then that are the key to her downfall?
I think the letters were the turning point. I'm not sure they had a case at all without the letters. But in terms of the ultimate outcome, I think there was more to it than that. There was extensive media coverage. Edith was vilified in the press.
Let's hear what the media had to say.
A shocking little piece of rubbish. And her mental furniture was meagre. I'm not asking for sympathy for Edith Thompson. She is a poor, flimsy, silly, mischievous little thing.
And here's Roz to bring in some copies of these newspapers for us to have a look at.
I've brought with me some copies of the Daily Sketch, which was Edith's favourite newspaper. It was also one of the mass circulation dailies from the 1920s.
When I look at that, I think Hello Magazine, pictures of people.
Or a tabloid.
They are the early tabloids, and this is also the kind of the advent of photography from about the turn of the 20th century. You get photographs in newspapers, and by the interwar period, of course, they're absolutely splashed all over the front pages. This case was referenced in legislation that came in soon after, which banned court photography.
It would nowadays be a contempt of court to take a photograph of barristers in court, or indeed anyone in court. Mm. That's why you have court drawers, court artists.
And it was this case in particular that fed into that legislation and brought about that change. These are newspapers that very much reflect public opinion, but they also have a role in shaping it. It's what we call the communication circuit as historians of the press. Mm. And it's not just the court reporting, obviously, it's the opinion pieces around it. And then, of course, it's other things that the paper kind of brings into bear, other articles. So here's an article about the case. We've got a bobbed hair ban on the side. And of course, Edith had
bobbed hair.
Bobbed hair. Here's another one. Mrs. Thompson's impassioned letters, where it's particularly referencing the poison. And on the side here, they bring in another case, and the article in question being the poisoned cake. So you can see how there's some kind of bias going on in the reporting, the way these things are packaged.
Now, even though the newspapers clearly turn against Edith, they should not be allowed to influence the course of the trial. What do you think Sasha really swung it for her?
When I read the judge's summing up, I was very, very concerned because the judge, in any case, has a duty to do two things. Firstly, to explain the law to the jury and to direct them that they've got to follow the law. Secondly, he summarises the facts in a way that is clear and enables them to understand what the issues are. This judge did neither. He did not explain the most fundamental aspects of the law in this case. The jury had absolutely no assistance, and the summary of the facts was almost like a stream of consciousness. Happily, today, judges are trained properly, extensively, regularly, and told how to provide sensible, clear, and nowadays written directions on the law for juries.
So in a sense, poor Edith then was really unlucky. She was found guilty by a jury just because the judge was incompetent.
Well, it wasn't only that the judge was less than competent, is the way I'd put it, but he also made his views about Edith's morality, making it quite plain that the person he believed was culpable was Edith Thompson. Never should a judge take on the mantle of the prosecution during the course of his summing up.
Freddie ends up being a bit of a hero, doesn't he? Even though he's a murderer. And Edith's own favourite newspaper, The Daily Sketch, actually started a petition to appeal against the verdict. But that petition, it wasn't for Edith. It was for Freddie. For many onlookers, Freddie was innocent, even though he'd confessed to the murder. Because Edith, who was merely a witness to the murderer, was a treacherous adulteress, she's the one seen as the real criminal.
And it's important to put this in the context of the time, which is the Great War had just ended and many young men had been lost in battle. And Freddie then represented the future. Here was a young man on trial who was about to lose his life as well. And so that made it easier to put the blame back on Edith Thompson.
Mm.
She very much represented change in the period. Her sense of dress, her career, her participation in mass leisure of the time, her childlessness, and of course her affair, her kind of very outright sexuality, and it really fueled a modern panic about women's place in society. So it's basically a new woman on trial. And in the court and in the press, she loses.
Edith and Freddie are hanged on the 9th of January 1923. The two executions occur simultaneously at 9 a.m, only half a mile apart, with Edith at Holloway and Freddie at Pentonville Prison. Edith is just 29, Freddie just 20. It's a very nasty end for Edith, isn't it, Sasha?
Well, accounts of the hanging of Edith, which have remained, describe a particularly brutal hanging, with Edith completely losing her self-control, being hysterical, having to be propped up on a chair. And then this account that she hemorrhaged once she had been executed, suggesting that there was possibly a pregnancy at the time, which would, of course, have meant that the death penalty would have been commuted to life imprisonment had it been known about.
That's just another thing that makes this case so unjust, isn't it?
I agree. And having read the judge's summing up, the only conclusion I can draw was that this was a miscarriage of justice.
Edith Thompson. Her conviction was less to do with murder than it was to do with her being a member of this generation of modern women. Writer Edgar Wallace had this to say: "Never in our history has there been so terrible a miscarriage of justice, or a verdict based so little upon evidence and so much upon prejudice, as that which sent Edith Thompson to that filthy scene in Holloway Jail."
And there's a final twist in this tale. A century on from her hanging, at the time of our recording, the Deputy Prime Minister has referred this case to the Criminal Cases Review Commission. They're going to investigate a potential miscarriage of justice. Will there be a posthumous pardon for Edith?
Next time on Lady Killers, we're heading to London's West End to the Savoy Hotel. Here we'll meet Marguerite Farmy, the French socialite who shot her husband and got away with it. Lady Killers with Lucy Worsley was produced by Nicola Humphreys, and the readers are Claire Corbett and Jonathan Keeble. Sound design is by Chris McLean, and the series producer is Julia Habel. It's a Story Hunter production for BBC Radio 4.
The world is on the brink. Wars, contentious elections, disinformation spreading at warp speed, and Donald Trump at the center of all of it. But what does it mean for the rest of us? Every week on Pod Save the World, Tommy Vitor and I cut through the noise to explain how global power is shifting. No jargon, no homework, just clear, honest conversations about what's happening and why it matters. From breaking news to long simmering international conflicts, We dissect it all with critical analysis and some jokes that will surely embarrass our children one day. Tune in to Pod Save the World every Wednesday, wherever you get your podcasts, or catch it on YouTube.